Today, we take a close look at the Taliban.
Any attempt to sort of isolate the Taliban would actually just push them into the sort of place they were in the late 90s.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, family members reunite with a kid running into his uncle's arms.
When we met, he was running and hugged me and he didn't care.
Our investigation reveals what happens when other families get sent back across the border they just crossed. And the U.S. climate envoy goes to China. The two countries are the biggest contributors to global warming.
The world cannot get where the world needs to go on climate change if China does not increase its ambition.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Since the Taliban took back control of Afghanistan, there's been a lot of waiting, wondering, and worrying about how they will rule the country. But we wanted to go a bit more granular and ask, who makes up the Taliban today? It's not a simple question, and we don't expect a simple answer. Ahmed Walid Khakar is going to take a stab at it. He's the editor of The Afghan Eye, an independent media outlet, and he's based in London. Ahmed, my first question is about the person who's been named the head of the Taliban-led Afghan government, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar. Who is he?
Well, he is from southern Afghanistan, and he essentially cut his teeth in the Afghan political battlefield during the Soviet invasion and occupation. He partook in what was called the Soviet Jihad. And obviously, after the withdrawal of the Soviet forces and the collapse of the puppet communist government, we saw a surge in infighting amongst the Mujahideen. And in 1994, essentially what were a group of Mujahideen commanders, leaders in southern Afghanistan got together and formed a political organization called the Taliban. And now the Taliban means literally students, and as a social or educational network, they've existed for centuries in the south of the country from which Mullah Baradar is from. But this was the first time they became a political organization. So Mullah Baradar, Abdul Ghani Baradar, is essentially, for all intents and purposes, a co-founder of the Taliban, a veteran.
I want to move to the rank and file members of the Taliban. Who are they in terms of background, education, where they're from?
The rank and file, it's difficult to sort of characterize them as a monolith. However, the way in which we could essentially characterize them is generally rural, religiously educated, so they are literate, they can read and they can write, and generally very young, so almost, you know, in their mid-20s, most of them don't remember the Taliban's previous government in the late 1990s. Rather, their only real remembered experience is that of living after 2001 in a U.S. occupation.
What about women in the Taliban or women who support the Taliban, say those who are married to members of the Taliban? Who are they, sociologically speaking?
Sociologically speaking, the women married to the Taliban or who form part of the Taliban's kinship networks would be people who are from the same valleys, districts, villages, clans, and tribes that the Taliban fighters and their leaders themselves belong to. With regard to women supporters of the Taliban, we saw protests a couple of days ago of women in Kabul who essentially form what we could say is the ultra-conservative demographic within Afghan society, protesting against the previous regime, protesting in favor of the Taliban. However, in terms of actually supporting the Taliban, obviously there was a large stigma associated with being pro-Taliban, which would explain why a lot of these women were perhaps muted up until this point. But there have been more attempts to co-opt women's rights activists and to use them to essentially disseminate the message of women should go to schools and their offices as usual under the new Taliban government.
The sort of rural nature, less educated profile of people in the Taliban, it's often looked at in the West or through media as these people are from villages, they're not educated. Put that in context in Afghanistan.
Well, in the context of Afghanistan, the fact that they're from villages and the fact that they are uneducated or not educated enough actually makes them rather uniquely placed to claim that they're representatives of Afghanistan. And what I mean by that is that the overwhelming majority of Afghanistan's population are young, but they also live in rural areas, about 75 to 80% of them. Universal schooling in Afghanistan never really took off in a way that we would sort of expect in the West. Most of the country is still illiterate. So the Taliban actually utilized that to argue against the previous regime by saying, look, this bunch of foreign imported technocrats who are highly educated are simply out of touch with the rest of the country.
What are your biggest concerns moving forward about how the international community deals with the Taliban, given legitimate concerns about how they might rule Afghanistan, but mm-hmm. knowing what you do about the country?
I think even very early on in the U.S. occupation, they sort of realized that their previous mode of governance was an utter failure. And with regard to my fears of the international community, what I would say is that any attempt to sort of isolate the Taliban would actually just push them into the sort of place they were in the late 90s, where they tyrannized Afghans, where they were brutal, and in which they didn't actually have to answer to any sort of international opinion. By engaging with the Taliban, whether or not we like them, whether or not they are palatable, or whether or not they share all of our values in the West, I think it's essential to keep a channel of communication open to engage with them, because that would make them feel, more than anything, a need to act as a responsible member of the international community.
Ahmed Waleed Kakar is the editor of the Afghan Eye. He's been speaking to us from London. Thank you so much, Ahmed.
Thank you very much for having me, Carol.
The 16th Summer Paralympics are coming to an end this weekend. The Games have been a reminder of the power of sports, especially in Uganda, where there's been more of an effort to boost participation in sports among people with physical disabilities. The World's Halima Gikandi brings us a story from Uganda's capital, Kampala.
During last week's 1500-meter finale, Paralympians from around the world made their final sprint to the finish line.
David Among in third place is doing his best to keep up there. The man from Uganda.
David Among ended up winning a bronze, his second Paralympic medal. It was Uganda's second medal, too. Mpindi Bumali is the president of Uganda's Paralympic Committee. He's in Tokyo now and tells me that David Among has made a big impact on para sports in the country since 2016.
So that was the first time Uganda got its first Paralympic medal. So that opened up the eyes of government, the eyes of the public, and also the perception started changing.
The perception about physical disability in Uganda, he means. Bumali tells me the Ugandan government is starting to see that disabled athletes are worth investing in. This year, they sponsored four Paralympians to go to Tokyo. But Bumali says he wants to see more.
Do you find that the government can, say, fund 200 able-bodied athletes? And then it found like at most 10.
5 to 10 disabled athletes at most. Bumali says that type of sports discrimination starts very early.
So initially, a person with disability or children with disability were left out. But we managed to lobby them. We managed to tell them that, look, here, it is the right of these children to also to participate in physical education.
Disability activists in Uganda have been pushing for more access to sports for adults, too. Apollo Mukasa directs the Uganda National Action on Physical Disability. The organization runs sports programs for disabled adults around Uganda.
We began with a few like sitting volleyball, pitch soccer, and then wheelchair basketball and boccia.
Bocce, that's the Italian ball sport that is much harder to play than it looks. Mukasa says sports can be confidence boosters for disabled Ugandans. He knows that firsthand and has dabbled in wheelchair volleyball. Mukasa says playing sports changes the way people see you.
In the long run, they start respecting you. You began getting more friends, coming to your home, which couldn't be the case before they could see you playing a game. So it's another attitude changer.
He says this is important because there are still a lot of cultural stigmas about people with disabilities.
In Uganda, when you go down there in the rural areas, deep there in the communities, when you find a family with a disabled person, they call it a caste family.
Mukasa says Ugandan para-athletes like runner David Among and the 14-year-old swimmer Husna Kukundakwe are making a difference and inspiring the next generation. The Support Disabled Children GABA organization in Kampala has been around since 2015. It's helping more than 40 young people with various physical disabilities. Alvin Waswa has cerebral palsy. He and his friends put on a boccia demonstration for me. Director Betty Nankabira interprets for him.
And he said that maybe if he can get sponsors and they sponsor them, they also go to Olympic.
She says they're really just getting started. Disabled athletes in Uganda still need a lot more support. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Kampala.
Japan's prime minister is leaving office, having served for just over a year. Yoshihide Suga announced today that he will not stand for re-election on September 29th. That gives his political rivals just a few weeks to campaign to be his successor. Gerald Curtis has studied Japanese politics for decades. He joins us now from Western Mass. Gerald Curtis, how surprised were you to hear Prime Minister Suga's announcement?
I wasn't surprised. I wasn't sure that he was going to resign, but I actually published a piece for a Japanese think tank just 3 days ago, in which I said it's quite possible that he's going to resign because the floor is falling out from under him.
What caused the downfall of Prime Minister Suga in terms of his popularity?
So the last thing that caused the downfall was indeed the lack of his popularity, and he realized he probably could not win re-election. And if he did, it would be bad for the party going into a major national election. So why was he so unpopular? When he came in, his popularity was quite high. But as prime minister, he soon showed, one, he couldn't get his arms around how to deal with the COVID crisis. So they would declare states of emergency, did it now five times. There was never a lockdown. They didn't produce their own vaccine. They were very slow to get vaccinations going. Then he sort of barreled ahead with the Olympics, even though the public was opposed to holding the Olympics. And in the end, what cost him his job is something that is not uniquely Japanese. It's true for all democracies, that a leader has to be able to communicate to the public what he wants to accomplish, how he's going to do it, what his vision is for the future. Mr. Suga, he has some skills, but communicating is not one of them.
How important is the prime minister's role in Japan?
It's really important if you want anything to change. The prime minister has to persuade the public, persuade the politicians, persuade the bureaucracy, persuade everybody that this change is necessary. And the fact that he couldn't communicate, that he didn't really get across to the public how he was going to make things better in the future than they are now or have been in the past, well, they didn't like it. And his popularity just kept on going down until he was down.
What will his successor, whoever that is, have on their plate?
The main thing, the challenge for the successor, is to convince the Japanese public that they know how to steer this ship of state and someone who can operate on the world stage effectively. And that was one of Mr. Suga's problems. He was a very domestic-oriented fellow, never had a position that involved foreign affairs. So the next prime minister has to be someone who the world finds interesting to talk with and who has something to say on climate change, on Afghanistan, on how to deal with China, and who's not just reading notes written by bureaucrats, which is what Mr. Suga was doing, but who actually has thought about these issues.
You mentioned China, and this change in Japanese leadership comes as China is trying aggressively to expand its economic and military power in the region. And the U.S. looks to Japan as America's strongest ally in East Asia. What will the U.S. need to do to keep this relationship on track?
Well, the U.S.-Japan relationship is very strong, and you can have prime ministers rise and fall, come and go, as they have been for the last half a century. And frankly, it doesn't really affect the relationship. It's so important for the U.S. to have an alliance with Japan. You know, China is the great power in the region. Japan is a powerful country, and it's the number three economy in the world, but it's not a great power like the United States. So how to deal with China? That's going to be the big issue when the new prime minister makes his pilgrimage to Washington to introduce himself to President Biden. I think the main thing on President Biden's mind is how are we going to coordinate to deal effectively with China?
Gerald Curtis is the Burgess Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Columbia University. He's been talking to us about the impact of today's announcement that Prime Minister Suga of Japan is stepping down. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Venezuela's economic and political problems long ago extended beyond the country's borders. Millions of Venezuelans, about one-fifth of the country's population, have fled to other countries. This weekend, representatives from the government and opposition parties are meeting in Mexico City with international mediators. For more on this, we have The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, on the line from Mexico City. Jorge, the government and opposition in Venezuela have dueling claims on power. Why are the two sides meeting? I mean, what do they want?
Carol, the many reasons for the meetings that are happening this weekend in Mexico City can be summed up into one word: stalemate. The authoritarian regime of Nicolás Maduro has strengthened its control on power in Venezuela over the last few years. But at the same time, Venezuela is a pariah. It is isolated from most of South America and much of the world. Jorge Rodriguez is a former vice president and the main emissary and the person who is speaking on behalf of Nicolás Maduro here in Mexico City this weekend. He made some remarks to the state television Telesur earlier this week.
Nosotros vamos ya con algunas propuestas, sobre todo enfocadas en el tema económico y social, en la atención del pueblo de Venezuela.
So here's Rodriguez saying that they have a number of proposals, but they are mostly focused on the economy because Venezuela has been economically sanctioned by the United States and by European governments who see Nicolás Maduro as an illegitimate president.
And of course, there's opposition leader Juan Guaido, who a few countries around the world still consider the president.
Yeah, the opposition led by Juan Guaido has not succeeded in their efforts to unseat the person who they see as a dictator. Their strategy has mostly been to rally amongst themselves because the opposition is a broad tent. It is many groups. It has been also to rally on the streets and to use the international pressure, but they haven't succeeded so far. So here is what Juan Guaido said in a statement today from Venezuela about this weekend's meetings.
Hoy inicia la primera ronda de negociación con el acompañamiento de la comunidad internacional, donde nuestro objetivo es lograr un acuerdo que solucione el conflicto.
Here, Juan Guaido is saying that their objective with these meetings is to find a resolution through fair elections, because one of the main points that all opposition groups have been making is that the elections through which Nicolás Maduro has been elected have been rigged.
And of course, the news this week is that the Venezuelan opposition is going to take part in November regional and local elections. So that's kind of interesting.
Yes, that is actually quite a big deal because the opposition has been very adamant in saying that the elections in Venezuela are illegitimate. And so they have, for years, they have refused to participate. But this week, they said that they would field candidates in some of these local elections in November. And so many in Venezuela see this as a concession to the Nicolás Maduro for these negotiations because the Nicolás Maduro administration wants there to be opposition in the elections because they see that as a way of gaining international legitimacy.
These upcoming talks aren't the first time Nicolás Maduro's regime has met with opposition leaders. I mean, what's different this time around? I mean, why do people expect anything new out of these kind of talks?
Both Nicolás Maduro and leaders of the opposition agreed that these sanctions are hurting the daily lives of Venezuelans. Venezuela is a country where many people have food scarcity, where there are electricity outages, and the list goes on. This time around, the Norwegian government is facilitating these meetings. It is the Norwegian Center for Conflict Resolution. And there is also the participation of other countries who are formally observing these talks. That's Bolivia, Turkey, Russia, and the Netherlands.
The World's Jorge Valencia in Mexico City. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Carol.
U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry spent this week in China. He went there seeking to try to persuade the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases to do more to keep climate change in check. For insight into Kerry's brand of climate diplomacy and the outcome of the talks, we turn to David Wade, who was Kerry's chief of staff when the diplomat was Secretary of State. David, what were the main goals that Kerry had going into these meetings?
As we head towards, 50 days away from COP26 in Glasgow, his goal was to really keep the sense of urgency alive with China, trying to urge the Chinese to see the opportunity of being more ambitious about things like reducing coal, things like changing the way that they are financing coal around the world, even as they are reducing their greenhouse gas emissions at home. Just as a matter of math, not ideology, the world cannot get where the world needs to go on climate change if China does not increase its ambition.
You mentioned John Kerry's goal to leave politics out of climate talks, but that's kind of hard. I mean, for example, China has gotten a lot of heat for manufacturing solar products using forced Uyghur labor in Xinjiang. How do you keep out politics?
I think it is helpful that Kerry has seen in his own history that if two sides want to get to an outcome, they are pretty good at finding ways
to cabin off other difficult issues and to focus on the matter at hand. You know, if two sides want to achieve one outcome, they can successfully put aside those other difficult issues in the relationship. But I also think he feels climate change should not be seen as a bilateral issue. Yes, the United States and China are the world's two biggest polluters. And yes, the rest of the world is going to take signals about what commitments they make from the commitments that the world's two biggest polluters make. That said, this is an issue for everybody. This is an issue for the world.
After Envoy Kerry's talks this week with his Chinese counterpart, Xie Jianhua, the spokesman for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Wang Wenbin, gave a press conference. He says the U.S. should shoulder its legal responsibilities and should begin to cooperate meaningfully with developing countries. What's the response to accusations that the U.S. is not in a position to be telling other countries what to do when it's the world's second largest greenhouse gas emitter and historically the biggest?
First of all, Envoy Kerry, going back to his years as a United States senator attending the first global climate conferences, has always been someone pushing and urging the United States to do our part. And the United States is very successfully reducing its own emissions, unlike China, which is obviously rising. But I think the short answer is we're not lecturing the rest of the world. What the United States is trying to do is to paint a picture of a clean energy revolution that everyone is in this together, and that the United States is willing to lead and to do its part, whether it's on technology transfer, whether it is on helping developing countries make the energy changes that are going to be in all the world's interests.
You spoke to John Kerry while he was on his way home from China. How did he characterize the trip?
That conversations are constructive. He always says that diplomacy, you know, you plant seeds, you tend to the garden, but the moment has to ripen. And we will see whether China decides that the opportunity is ripe to do what the world would like to see them do. But you continue tending to that garden.
David Wade served as chief of staff for John Kerry when he was Secretary of State. He runs the Kerry Initiative at Yale University, which focuses on global challenges. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Carol.
You're with the world. Next week marks 20 years since 9/11. It's reshaped our world in obvious ways and not so obvious ones.
We were one people, and now we're no longer one people. Maybe that's what 9/11 did. Maybe it made the separation really real.
Coming up, the cultural costs of tightened borders right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. With the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban, many Afghans are expected to flee their homeland. For years now, thousands of Afghans have made the dangerous journey by land to Europe. But in several European countries, authorities are increasingly being accused of expelling migrants arriving on their soil, migrants with a legal right to apply for asylum. Organizations that track so-called pushbacks say Greece is a major culprit, that thousands of people trying to enter through Turkey have been illegally sent back. The Greek government strongly denies these allegations. In collaboration with the German news magazine Der Spiegel, we've been investigating one recent case. The World's Lydia Amanalidou in Athens has the story. We're using only our sources' first names as they fear for their safety.
When Hussein's parents told him he'd be traveling from Syria to Greece, he was thrilled because his favorite uncle is a refugee living in Athens. He says he was so excited and eager to go see his uncle that when he'd misbehave, his mother would threaten not to send him as punishment. Hussein is 14 years old, but he's really small for his age, looks about 7 or 8. He has severe scoliosis and 12 metal screws in his back. His family's from Manbij in northern Syria. In 2015, their home was bombed by President Assad's forces. Two of Hussein's cousins were killed in that blast, and the family relocated elsewhere in Syria. Hussein says life there was not good. There was war, bombs, and no school. In Syria, he also couldn't get the medical attention he needed for his scoliosis. So when some family members and neighbors said they were going to try to make it to Europe, Hussein's parents reluctantly sent him along. In late April, the group crossed into northern Greece through the land border with Turkey. There were two kids, including Hussein, and several adults who documented the journey. Their plan was to drop off Hussein with his uncle, Ayman, and for the rest of them to try to make it to another EU country on foot. Ayman remembers how shocked he was when he got the call that the group had already crossed into Greece.
It was a surprise for me, and they told me, we are in Greece, come to take Hussein. I thought, what are you talking about?
Ayman knew his nephew was coming, but not exactly when. And at the time, there were domestic travel restrictions in Greece because of COVID, which meant that the uncle couldn't drive the roughly 600 miles from Athens to the northern border where the group was still traveling on foot. Ayman was worried sick that his nephew and the rest would be pushed back to Turkey, so he and a lawyer friend in Athens started frantically making phone calls and sending emails to major aid groups and NGOs that work with refugees. They wanted to create a paper trail proving the group had made it to Greece. They also tried to find someone to accompany Hussein to get registered with authorities, but no one would agree to do it. Ayman couldn't even get guarantees that the group would be legally processed if they presented themselves to Greek police.
I felt so sad. I felt so angry. I couldn't help them. I couldn't do anything. Help them to be safe, at least.
Meanwhile, Hussein and the rest kept moving deeper into Greek territory. Through the single phone they all shared, they'd send daily updates to family to tell them they're okay. In this video, you see them walking on a hill overlooking a village, holding tree branches and sticks to help with the trek. The World and Der Spiegel reviewed dozens of pieces of footage like this, videos, audio messages, texts, and other geo-tagged materials to verify details of the journey. And here's how it worked. Every day, the adults would receive a digital map with directions on where to go. They'd get the info from a Facebook group run by self-proclaimed humanitarian smugglers. They'd use those instructions and walk all night while it was dark to avoid being spotted by authorities, farmers, and other people in the area. While the sun was out, they'd sleep or just stay put. In this video, you see them in the forest, just waiting. Hussein sits on a tree log right next to the only other kid traveling with the group, 12-year-old Mohammed. Mohammed tells me he and Hussein knew each other from Syria, but became close friends, partners even, on this journey. The two would walk side by side at night and huddle during the idle hours of the day. And together, they'd dream up their future lives in Europe. Hussein says he would talk about how he'd eventually go to Holland and Mohammed to Germany, where they each have family. They'd talk about how they'd get rich and visit each other. And they had this inside joke about which one of them would own the nicest cell phone. The boys say having one another helped them cope with the difficult and often terrifying journey. Hussein's scoliosis sometimes made the walking unbearably painful. Everyone was constantly afraid of being spotted. A couple times they were chased through the woods by farmers' dogs, and they were often cold, thirsty, and hungry. At one point during the journey, Mohammed says the group ran out of food for nearly 3 days. He says they survived by eating leaves and whatever else they could pick off of trees. After 12 days of walking and hiding in Greece, the group got some good news. Hussein's uncle was finally on his way up north. They arranged to meet him at a small village, and the adults told Hussein the reunion had to be discreet. They didn't want anyone to notice them because, remember, their plan was to keep going, to try to get to another EU country. But Hussein couldn't help himself. He tried to casually walk towards his uncle, but found himself running. He'd slow down and walk, but then he'd start running again. Ayman, the uncle, remembers when the two finally spotted each other. He says he could barely see Hussein's face because it was covered in dirt.
But when we met, he was like just he was running and hugged me, and he didn't care about
it. Hussein speaks in Arabic, then Ayman translates.
And when I was in your hug, I... I felt safe and no one will scare me.
After getting Hussein cleaned up, fed, and dressed, the two headed back to Athens. They were elated to be reunited and eager to get the asylum process started for Hussein. But once they got to the Greek capital, that joy quickly vanished. A family member told Ayman that the rest of the group had gone silent. No one had heard from them for more than a day. When they finally resurfaced, it turned out 12-year-old Mohammed and the rest of the group had been pushed back to Turkey.
So if we could start with them, can you just tell us where you are right now?
Fouad, one of the adults in the group, says they're in Istanbul. Mohammed, who's Fouad's nephew, sits next to him as the two recount the harrowing story of how they ended up there. After making it some 150 kilometers, about 100 miles, into Greece, Fouad says they were spotted by a man who zip-tied them and started beating them. Mohammed tried to escape and hide in a nearby graveyard, but then police showed up and Mohammed surrendered. Fouad says they were put in a van and taken to one Greek police station and then another. He says they were being transported and detained along with dozens of other people, mostly men from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Fouad claims no one asked any of them whether they were seeking asylum or even tried to get their names. Instead, at each police station, Fouad claims they were stripped naked, searched, and beaten by uniformed and plainclothes officers. This part of the journey is the hardest for Mohammed, the boy, to talk about. He says that at the third and final police station they were taken to, everyone was once again ordered to strip down and throw their clothes into a pile. After being searched, they were told to get dressed, but anyone who tried to sift through the pile to find his own clothes was beaten. Mohammed froze. He didn't want to get hurt. So when he and others were taken out of the station, he was completely naked. As he talks about this, he looks down and avoids eye contact. Authorities then took Mohammed and the rest to the river that separates the Greek-Turkish land border. They ordered the group to walk part of the way, and Mohammed says he was crying the whole time because he was so embarrassed. He'd never been naked publicly like that before, and he says he's still has nightmares about it. Eventually, Mohammed and dozens of others were split into smaller groups. They say they were then forced onto inflatable rafts and ferried across to Turkey. From there, they walked to the nearest village and found a mosque where they were given food and clothes. In Turkey, an NGO called Cesur, which monitors pushbacks and other border violence, documented the group's bodily injuries and took their testimonies. Their accounts resemble the stories of thousands of others who say they, too, were subjected to brutal and illegal treatment and prevented from seeking asylum. And like many others who claim they've been pushed back, Fouad, Mohammed, and the rest of their group say they have no choice but to try to make the journey once again.
That was the world's Lydia Amanalidou, who's with me now on the line. Lydia, what did Greek authorities say when you asked them about this case?
Well, we reached out to the Civil Protection Ministry, which oversees the police units that the people in this story say they were taken to. A spokesperson told us that there was no record of this incident and that generally border control operations in Greece are in line with international laws and respect people's fundamental rights. This is the kind of typical response that Greek authorities give when there are allegations or reports of pushbacks, even well-documented ones. And authorities say that when that happens, when there are reports or allegations of pushbacks, they take them very seriously and they investigate them, but that so far they have found no evidence of wrongdoing.
But as you've reported, there's evidence to suggest otherwise. How widespread is this practice thought to be?
Well, NGOs that track this say that we're talking about thousands of people being pushed back from the Greek sea and land borders every year. And they claim that this practice, even though it's not new, that it's become systematic and coordinated. Amnesty International put out a report this summer, and in that report it described pushbacks as the de facto border control policy at Greece's borders. And you know, Carol, it's not just Greece. There are other countries in the EU and in the region that are accused of pushbacks. Croatia, Hungary, Italy, and others. Yesterday on the show, as you might remember, we had on the EU's top migration official, Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson, who told us this is something she's really concerned about, these reports of pushbacks. And she said there are right now discussions to get countries like Greece to set up independent monitoring mechanisms to make sure this doesn't happen.
Finally, Lydia, where are Hussein and Mohammed and their families at this point?
So Hussein, who's the 14-year-old who was picked up by his uncle, he's in Athens at a shelter for unaccompanied minors. He had to be put there in order to go through the asylum process. He says he really likes it there. He's made friends. He's able to do activities like play soccer, which he really loves. Mohammed, the 12-year-old who ended up in Turkey, he's still there with his uncle last time I checked in with them. The two boys, Mohammed and Hussein, they regularly talk on the phone. They told me that, you know, sometimes they talk about what happened to them and they try to make sense of it. They say they've been researching some YouTube videos to try to understand why pushbacks happen, but they don't really quite get it. And as for the adults they were with, some of them say they're preparing to make this journey once again once they've raised enough money. And Mohammed, again, the kid, told me that if and when his uncle does try to make the trip to Europe again, he'll go with him despite the experience he had, because he says he wants to be able to go to school, he wants to have a future and a normal life like any other kid.
So what about Hussein? Will he be processed and then eventually possibly allowed to live in Greece and in the EU?
Yeah, so Hussein right now is going through the steps. And in order for that to start, he had to be put in that shelter. And so, yes, ideally, he would be granted asylum and would be able to stay in Greece or go to another EU country. He has family in Holland, and he hopes to eventually be able to go there and reunite with them.
The World's Lydia Amanalidou. Thank you so much. It was a terrific report.
Thanks, Carol.
Alejandro Prieto has spent a lot of time at a different border than the one we've been talking about, the U.S.-Mexico border. The Mexican photographer was drawn to the region to document the wildlife and the impact of the border wall on the migratory patterns of animals. Now, one of his photographs of a roadrunner staring at the enormous wall has earned him the grand... Now, one of his photographs of a roadrunner staring at the enormous wall has earned him the grand prize in the Bird Photographer of the Year competition. Prieto describes how he captured his prey.
The roadrunner photograph was taken pretty close to Naco in the state of Arizona. And I was driving my car along the road the Border Patrol uses when I suddenly saw this little bird appear from the forest. It walked to the half of the road and stop for a while, looking straight to the wall. That gave me enough time to stop the car, and it was a really quick moment. I managed to have a couple of pictures, and the roadrunner just look at the wall and go back directly from the point that where it appeared. I start thinking about this project because I used to hear the news speaking about immigration and speaking about many, many issues at the border between Mexico and USA, but never heard about problems that this wall is causing all the wildlife that lives in this area. I spent maybe 16 months through all the territory from California to Texas. I spent a lot of time. It's well known that many migratory species live in this area. It's very important for these species to move. Even more important, some critically endangered species, like the jaguar. There are only a few jaguars living in the United States. So constructing a big wall will be the end for this species in the United States. I had to say that it has been the most difficult one because I had to face many challenges. One of them was an insecurity. This place is used for Mexican drug cartels to send drugs to the United States. Another challenge I had to face is the Border Patrol harassment. I knew it was a good shot, but I didn't realize how good it was until probably weeks later when I was in my house checking out the pictures. That's where I knew that it was a very strong and a very, very powerful picture. A lot of people told me that this picture had touched them, and I think this is very important because the goal of my work is to provoke changes, to provoke people to act.
You can see Alejandro Prieto's captivating roadrunner photograph at our Instagram page, theworld.org/Instagram. A week from tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Starting today and continuing next week, we'll be looking at how those attacks have changed our world over the last two decades. One way is restrictions at the U.S. borders with Canada and Mexico have gotten a lot tighter. The effects of that can be seen everywhere, in trade and tourism, but it's also left a mark on border culture. Some locals in northern Maine, where many people speak French, say 9/11 has affected efforts to preserve the French language. From Fort Kent, Maine, Levi Bridges reports.
Driving up toward the northern tip of Maine, there's not a lot on the radio. Most stations here are in French, broadcast from Canada. Some of the first French speakers to arrive in this region were the Acadians. They settled on either side of the St. John River that divides northern Maine and Canada. French was the dominant language in this part of Maine for more than a century, but it started to decline when Maine passed a law back in 1919 that forbid children from speaking French in school.
When you spoke French in school, you were belittled for it. You were made to write lines, "I will not speak French in school, I will not speak French in school."
Lisa Lavoie grew up here. Although Maine's anti-French law was repealed in the 60s, Lavoie says the effects were long-lasting. Her parents' generation grew up thinking French was a language that backwoods country bumpkins spoke, something to be ashamed of. Lavoie says she didn't even know the language she spoke really was French until one day as an adult when she called a hotel in Paris.
So I dial the number and I say, "Allô? Y a des étudiants de Fort Kent qui habitent à votre hôtel."
She wasn't sure the receptionist would even understand her main French. And Lavoie was totally floored because they had no problems communicating. She calls this moment her epiphany.
I said to myself, "Wow, this French has value. Are you kidding me? Like, I can have a conversation with someone from Paris."
Because before, you just didn't think about it as something that was useful.
Right, not really. It was just something that I had been led over the course of time to believe was inferior.
That's part of why French is dying out in Maine. Lavoie says her own daughter doesn't feel confident speaking it. Lots of people in Fort Kent have immediate family right over the border, where French is dominant. But maintaining those relationships became way more complicated after 9/11. In fact, Lavoie wrote her master's thesis about how the 2001 terrorist attack affected northern Maine. She takes me down to the border crossing in Fort Kent to see what's changed. Folks say that before, customs officers pretty much just waved you right through. Lavoie points out where the old customs house used to be.
When I was a kid, it literally wasn't much bigger than a typical run-of-the-mill ranch house. It was white, I believe, with black shutters.
Now there are sets of big white pillars that separate lanes of traffic where U.S. customs officers screen passengers coming from Canada. All this was built post 9/11. Another big change, Americans started to need passports to enter Canada. And that was a deal breaker for some folks here. It cost a family of four more than $500 to get passports. Not exactly a small sum up here in Aroostook County, where the poverty rate is nearly a third higher than the national average. Lavoie says she crossed with a passport after 9/11.
They had gloves on and said, you know, open your trunk. Just went through my trunk like quite thoroughly. Can ask me all kinds of questions. Where are you going? Why'd you go there? I felt it was an antagonistic stance.
It made people like Lavoie not even want to go to Canada, which was heartbreaking because crossing the border helped connect her to the binational community of French speakers here, the Acadians.
We were one people, and now we're no longer one people. Maybe that's what 9/11 did. Maybe it made the separation really real.
In the first decade after 9/11, the number of people crossing the border here fell by nearly 50%. Lavoie says you just don't really hear many Canadians speaking French on the streets in Maine anymore.
You're having less French speakers come across your community, right? That can't help but impact the language. Whenever a language is less heard, I think it becomes less important.
The pandemic hasn't helped the situation. Canadians still can't cross land borders into Maine, and Americans need to go through a lot of red tape to enter Canada. But Canada is still so tantalizingly close. At the edge of the St. John River, there's nothing but a shallow stretch of water flowing over smooth, gray stones separating the two countries. Lise Pelletier, the former director of the Acadian Archives in Fort Kent, takes me to this spot near her house.
And so that's Canada right there across the river.
Yeah, and the entire other side of the St. John River is totally French.
All of Pelletier's grandkids live over there. She mostly sees them on Zoom these days. So last summer, Pelletier came down to the river and her six-year-old grandson walked to the shore on the Canadian side.
We just stood there and waved to each other for I don't know how many minutes, you know. There really is a difference, you know, between seeing your loved ones on a screen and seeing them in person.
Pelletier has dedicated most of her life to preserving the Acadian culture. She's seen firsthand how cross-border relationships help preserve the French language. Pelletier says there are parallels between Maine's anti-French history and the fear of outsiders we started seeing post 9/11.
It's just such a profound fear of the other, and it's all man-made. It's all driven by fear instead of being driven by hope and collaboration and working together.
We may never truly quantify what effect 9/11 had on Maine's French speakers, but if there's one thing that we've learned during the pandemic, it's that in-person connection is really worth a lot. For the world, I'm Levi Bridges in Fort Kent, Maine.
It's been quite the week, and we got to end it on some good news. Well, ABBA is back. I believe it would be fair to say you look bewildered and you wonder why I'm here today. And so you should, I would. One of Sweden's biggest exports dropped not one, but two new singles yesterday. Both have already zoomed up the streaming charts. The singles dropped ahead of ABBA's first studio album in 40 years. And if that's not enough, they're staging a series of concerts in London next spring. Live music, but the four band members themselves will be there in the form of digital avatars. Tickets go on sale next week. Perhaps platform shoes and satin shirts won't be far behind. ABBA, the 2021 version, closes our show today. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great Labor Day weekend, and we're back with you on Monday.